Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we're going to learn about D-Day and World War II and check on an upcoming event for our Vietnam veterans. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
June 6, 1944, 160,000 Allied troops landed along a 50-mile stretch of heavily fortified French coastline to fight Nazi Germany on the beaches of Normandy, France. Dwight D. Eisenhower called the operation a crusade in which we will accept nothing less than full victory. More than 5,000 ships and 13,000 aircraft supported the D-Day invasion. And by day's end, on June 6, the Allies gained a foothold in Normandy. The D-Day cost was high. More than 9,000 Allied soldiers were killed or wounded, but more than 100,000 soldiers began the march across Europe to defeat Hitler. This D-Day, I will pause and reflect on what our men and women in uniform have sacrificed for our country. I am in awe of great service in any generation. While demands and pressures are different today than they were on D-Day, selfless service prevails among our service members.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Doug Becky is a historian and the former curator of the Minnesota Military Museum. He served in the United States Special Forces in Vietnam, eventually retiring from the military as a major. Doug, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Haven't had you in the studio for a while, Doug, but we want to talk about D-Day as we've got an anniversary coming up. And my materials here say that 73 years ago, the Normandy landings, codenamed Operation Neptune, were the landing operations on Tuesday, 6 June 1944, termed D-Day, of the Allied invasion of Normandy in Operation Overlord during World War II. The largest seaborne invasion in history, the operation began the liberation of German-occupied northwestern Europe from the Nazi control and contributed to the Allied victory on the Western Front. So, Doug, there aren't too many World War II veterans left among us, but there's a few of them there because they still attend the honor flights and things. But 73 years ago doesn't seem like it's that long to me when I think about history.
I was just thinking about this morning, and if you think that we are about as far away from World War II as the World War II veterans were from the Civil War.
There's a perspective. The Civil War was 150 years or so ago?
Yeah.
Long time.
And another thing I remember, you know, I remember when I was 5 years old and I crawled into bed with my dad one morning and said, "Dad, tell me about the war." This was 1955. And for me and my images of it, it was these grainy black and white pictures and everything. And 10 years after Vietnam, 15 years after Vietnam, my kids crawled into bed with me and said, "Dad, tell me about the Army. Tell me about Vietnam." And I thought back to when I was 5 years old. And for me, my remembrances of Vietnam were technicolor and vivid and just as real as the day they happened. And for my father, 10 years after World War II, those images were just as real to him. But for other people that can't get in your head, they're grainy and they're old.
History Channel.
Black
stuff.
And white.
Yeah,
it's something else from someone else. And for the World War II veterans, when I talk to them, they're right back there. And it's a part of their life. It's as real as the two of us sitting right here.
And it was yesterday.
It was yesterday in their heads.
They remember it vividly.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, most of us remember December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and we got into war in the Pacific. But it was shortly after that that we got involved officially in the war in Europe. Can you explain that?
Well, the war in Europe had been going on since the 1st of September 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. And then, of course, the 1940, after what was called the sitting war in Western Europe, Germany invaded Holland. Germany invaded Norway and Denmark, and then in the spring of 1940, France fell, and that left England fighting alone. And in the fall of 40 was the Battle of Britain, pretty much a victory because it kept the Germans from invading England. And now Hitler had other ambitions, and the war turned east. And in the spring of 41, Hitler went into the Balkans, down as far as Greece, Yugoslavia. And then that delayed his big plan, which took place on the 22nd of June, 1941. He invaded Russia. And by December of 41, he was at the gates of Moscow. His army was completely worn out. Everything was frozen or wounded or out of supplies. But Russia launched a major counterattack, pushed the Germans back. About this same time, Pearl Harbor happened, as you mentioned. Roosevelt had a dilemma. Roosevelt knew that we had to support England. We had to support the Allies. We had to defeat Germany. Japan was an issue because of things that were going on in China and that, but I don't think it was the main focus in his mind. So December 7th, 1941, Japan attacks the United States. We have to go to war against Japan. I'm not sure that that was the war that Roosevelt really felt was going to be the most important. We still needed to support England. How are we going to do this? Hitler handed us the golden key. Couple days after December 7th, he declared war on us. Astounding is probably his greatest mistake of the war, because now it brought the massive weight of the United States into the war against Germany. And, you know, when we think about World War II, we think about the troops, we think about the planes, we think about the ships, we think about all these things. Almost none of these things existed in 1941. They just weren't there. And the real story of World War II, for especially the United States, and this is taking nothing away from the combat, but it's the logistics that we brought into the war. It was just absolutely incredible. The number of ships that we built, the number of tanks and trucks and planes, everything that we built, it was incredible. None of it existed in 1941. Most of it had to be designed and tested and then put into production. And you think of fielding the armies. I was talking to a school teacher years ago after Desert Storm, and she was complaining, well, how come they can't bring the troops home faster? We had 500,000 men over in the desert, men and women. And I said, well, have you ever run a field trip? And, oh, yeah, you got to get 30 students to some location. You got to plan getting a bus and maybe getting a lunch and all this stuff. Now, think about World War II. They had to do it for 15, 16 million people. Had to move them halfway across the world. All different kinds of theaters, prepare them for all different kinds of climactic conditions, supply them with everything from toothpaste to battleships and tanks. How do you do that? And the United States did it in a very, very short amount of time. It was just absolutely incredible.
And Doug, as you said, Hitler kind of did it for Roosevelt because he declared the Axis declared war on us and invited us into the war in Europe. And then Roosevelt and the Defense Department had to sit down and say, how are we going to fight a war on two fronts? But it kind of ended up that the Army and the Army Air Corps went to Europe and Navy and the Marines went to the Pacific, as it turned out.
Well, there was plenty of Army in the Pacific, too, and that was a dilemma. And the decision had to be made what was going to be the priority, and it was determined that the war in Europe was going to be the priority. So how are we going to proceed on that? Roosevelt had wanted to launch an invasion of France in 1942, and Churchill said, no, you can't do it. And to demonstrate to Roosevelt that it wasn't going to work, he set up the operation at Dieppe, which was a massive failure, and to demonstrate to Roosevelt that things weren't ready for the invasion yet. And we weren't ready for an invasion in Europe. And so after that, they did the invasion of North Africa, did the North African campaign, and Churchill got back to his idea about the soft underbelly of Europe, which led to the invasion of Sicily and then the invasion of Italy in September 43. Meanwhile, Russia is bearing the brunt of the war. They've stopped the Germans at Stalingrad, and they're on their way to losing 27 million people. They want a second front.
So, Doug, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we've set the stage for D-Day and what happened there. And when we come back, I want to talk about that the bravery that was involved in attacking those fortified shores. We're speaking with Doug Becky about D-Day and World War II on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking to Doug Becky, who is a historian and a former curator of the Minnesota Military Museum, about D-Day and World War II. And, Doug, we set the stage now of the war in Europe, and, of course, Japanese attacked the United States. We entered into a war on two fronts, and one in Europe and one over in the Pacific. And, of course, the Germans had an eastern front where they were getting beat up pretty bad by the Russians. And, of course, they were afraid that we were going to invade in Normandy. And just be leading up to that, our 34th Infantry Division Red Bulls had fought their way through Africa and up through Italy. And the day before D-Day, they liberated Rome.
And so much for any press coverage.
For about 10 minutes.
Yeah, for about 10 minutes. D-Day just overwhelmed everything else. And after that, the Italian front became something in the distant memory of people. So,
but they did a good job there, and they occupied about 18 German divisions and that might have otherwise been available for Normandy. And
right.
Here we are at Normandy. What are the logistics of that? How many men, ships, aircraft, and supplies and water? And it's got to be amazing.
Again, as I mentioned, you know, earlier, the Americans go to war with a very heavy footprint and huge number of troops, huge number of tanks, huge number of trucks, and everything that goes to supply them and take care of them, from toothpaste and shoelaces to all the food, three meals a day that they have to have, the gasoline, the spare tires, the spark plugs, everything that's needed for everything from an aircraft carrier to a battleship to a fleet of bombers to a motorcycle and in some cases bicycles that they'd ride around. Everything had to be provided. None of this existed in 1941 when we started the war. Most of it wasn't even in the design phase. And so it was absolutely an incredible effort by American industry and American workers to bring all these things online and then for the military planners to get everything where it needed to go. The English used to joke that they thought the island was going to sink because of the weight of all the material that was stacked all over England and the number of troops that were there. And the English also, well, there were several jokes about the Americans being there, but I won't go into that.
There were a lot of them.
There were a lot of them there. There were a lot of them there. So in late May, they start moving. And some of them go into isolation. Some of them are briefed on where they're going to go. Some cases they set up sand tables showing them where they were going to go with some detail. But for a lot of them, you know, they know they're going someplace, but they're not sure where they're going, and they're loading on ships. And is this going to be it? Is this another training operation? Is this the real thing? So that's on one side of the English Channel. On the other side of the English Channel, the Germans are sitting there, and they've had – about 3 years to get things ready. And they didn't do a very good job of it. Rommel came in. He was appointed to be in charge of all the coastal defenses on the North Sea. And that was in January of 1944. And he was pretty appalled by what he found, that they really didn't have things ready the way they needed to. So he started a massive program to get things going, to get commanders motivated to build up their defenses. And then there were problems in the German command structure. Ultimately, things went back to Hitler to make the final decisions, and he deprived a lot of his commanders of the ability to maneuver and to deploy their forces the way they needed to. Von Rundstedt, who was the commander of the German forces in the West, joked that he really only commanded the sentries outside of his door, that everything else had to go back to Hitler. There was also discussions among the Germans about where they thought the invasion was going to go. They had 2,000 miles of shoreline from Nordkap in Norway to the Spanish coast. So they had to be ready everywhere, and that was a huge logistical problem, and it caused them to dissipate their forces a lot. They had to cover all these coastal areas and waste all kinds of resources on building bunkers that would never defend anything. Additionally, there were questions on the German side about how they were to deploy their reserves. Rommel had had an experience at the Battle of the Kasserine Pass where he first encountered the American logistical system. He kind of wasted a day going around the battlefield and just looking at all the American supplies and trucks that had been lost and abandoned. And he was shocked to realize just what he was confronting. And he knew that logistics were going to be a huge problem. And the thing, the forces and the vehicles and the equipment that we could bring to bear in Normandy. And so Rommel's idea was to put the combat power forward, and he wanted all the reserves forward. Hitler and a lot of the other generals felt that the invasion was going to come at the Pas-de-Calais, which was the shortest crossing point in the English Channel. And so they wanted to hold the reserves farther back. And then move them forward when the war came. or when the invasion came. Rommel knew, and some other German generals knew, that this would pose problems moving them forward because of the tremendous Allied air superiority. And that did prove to be a problem. It became very difficult for the Germans to move their reserves forward when the time came.
We're speaking with Doug Becky about D-Day on Minnesota Military Radio. Doug, we've got about 5 minutes left in the huge battle to describe, but the Allies had a narrow window, just a couple of days. The weather wasn't good. The British and the Canadians and the Americans were ready to attack. That must have been a massive feat.
Because of the tides, they determined that the tides and the full moon, they determined that they had to do the invasion on the 5th, 6th, or 7th of June, or it would be delayed for weeks. And so they loaded up all the troops on the 4th, on the 3rd and 4th, had them ready to go on the 5th. Some of the ships were actually departing. The paratroopers were getting ready to go. And the meteorological situation was such that they decided they had to call it off, that they just couldn't do the landing. The Germans were also looking at the weather, and they determined that the landing couldn't happen because the weather was too difficult. Rommel went home to celebrate his wife's birthday in Württemberg. Some of the other German generals went to a war game in Rennes, so they were absent from their commands. The night of the 6th, or the night of the 5th, Eisenhower's looking at the weather situation again, makes the decision that they have to go on the 6th. Now, the troops have already been on the boats for maybe 24 hours. The airborne guys the night before got their adrenaline up and then had to bring it back down.
Stood down for...
they're loading up again. It's on double daylight saving time, so it doesn't get dark till about 11 o'clock. They load up the planes. They take off and fly over the invasion fleet. One of the veterans I talked to described it as pepper on a mirror looking down, as far as you could see, ships, 5,000 ships. 5,000 ships involved in the invasion, roughly 10,000 planes. Thousands of sorties are being flown. The Air Force is going after all the communication systems in France. The French underground has been alerted that the invasion's coming. And so they go after their targets. They had mostly communication bridges, communication lines.
The Navy's bombarding.
The Air Force was very successful in its bombardments on Utah Beach. They were not successful in their bombardments on Omaha Beach. The decision was made to go in at low tide on Omaha. The British decided to go in at a little bit later when the tide was up. Omaha Beach was a bad situation, but it was spotty too. The Germans defended. They only had about one battalion on Omaha Beach, and the rest of their troops were spread out. The German 352nd Division had a 30-mile front to cover, which was an impossible situation. And they only had one battalion on Omaha Beach and one battalion of artillery. But they were manning strong points, and it was the 1st Division and the 29th Division that went in on Omaha. And some of the guys got lucky. They went in between the strong points, and their landings were covered by the smoke and fires and that. And some of them were very unlucky, landed right in front of German strong points, and were slaughtered as they came out of the boats. By noon, they had pretty much worked their way up onto the heights and secured Omaha and got about a kilometer or so inland. The flaw in the German plan was that they had a crust on the coast, a fairly thin crust, and they had no backup. There was no second line. There was no defense in depth. So they had a limited number of counterattacking troops that were available, but very few. So now they were dependent on these reserves coming, in some cases, hundreds of miles from all over France and closing in. The Hitler Youth Division, got there fairly quickly and fought against the British, but others took days to get there, and of course, the entire time that they're moving, they're being bombarded by our Air Corps. So I think that the real triumph of Normandy was the success of our combined arms, and that was the Navy, which brought the troops there, which bombarded the coast and provided tremendous support. There were incidents where German units were forming up 15 miles inland, and the Navy bombarded these formations and stopped the attacks. This happened at Anzio, and it happened at Salerno too. The Air Force did a tremendous job, completely dominating the sky. It made it extremely difficult for the Germans to do anything. And then, of course, our infantry, our ground troops going in. And it was an incredible example of a combined force going and doing their job.
Massive invasion, massive effort 73 years ago. And you can find a lot more information on that at the library and some of the movies. And you've got a lot of information up at Camp Ripley at the Minnesota Military Museum. And that, what are the hours up there, Doug?
In the summer, they're open 7 days a week from the 1st of May till the end of September. And they're open from 10 to 5.
So when you're driving up north to go fishing this summer, swing into Camp Ripley, go over to the Minnesota Military Museum. Doug's got all kinds of exhibits in there, and the place is full, and it's fascinating. Schedule 2-3 hours, maybe 4, on a rainy day, and go on over there and teach your kids and your grandkids some lessons. Doug, appreciate you stopping back to the show.
Thank you.
That was Doug Becky, who is a historian and a former curator of the Minnesota Military Museum. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment to talk about an upcoming event for our Vietnam veterans. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to learn about an upcoming event for our Vietnam veterans. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, here's Commissioner Larry Shelleteau.
It's known fondly as the Star-Spangled Banner. Old Red, White, and Blue, Old Glory, Stars and Stripes, and the list goes on and on. The American flag is recognized across our country to far-reaching nations, even second and third world countries. Our flag stands as a beacon to the world, representing independence, liberty, patriotism, and freedom. It is a symbol of enduring hope. Each year, June 14th is recognized as Flag Day. Although this is a little-known and even less celebrated day, let's commit to spending time reflecting on our flag. Although it's made just of cloth, our flag represents all of those throughout history who have stood against our enemies, braved unspeakable conditions, and sustained injuries. Some even gave their lives. Let us fly it proudly with honor and loyalty. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelleteau. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now is Bob Behrens, who is president of Chapter 290, St. Cloud National Vietnam Veterans of America. He's also the co-chair of the Agent Orange Committee, and we'll find out later that he's the chairman of something called the Squadron of Happy Hookers. Bob, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks for having me back, Tom. It's good to see you.
Yep, good to have you in here. We haven't had you on the radio for a while, so how's all our Vietnam veterans doing up at the St. Cloud chapter?
We're good to go. We're active. We got a lot of things going on. We're involved in a lot of community events, veterans affairs, and it's all good. It's all good.
So everybody's pitching in, doing a good job?
Absolutely.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, Bob, I understand you've got a little event coming up. Can you tell us what it is, 10th anniversary of something?
It's the 10th anniversary of the Vietnamese Veteran Memorial this Saturday. At noon at Lake George in St. Cloud, they're going to be celebrating, or not so much celebrating, but it's the Vietnamese Veterans Memorial Day. And this is the 10th anniversary of this memorial. You know, back in 2004, a group of Vietnamese, Vietnam veterans and the VVA 290 went to the city council of St. Cloud and asked for approval to start a memorial. And they got the approval in April, and then they proceeded to build this outstanding memorial. It's 10 foot by 6 foot out of black marble to commemorate the Vietnam conflict, the war, with the involvement of with the Vietnamese veterans and the Vietnam veterans. And there's etched in the marble, there's two pictures of not only American Vietnam veterans, but also the Vietnamese veterans. It was a great partnership that they developed, and it's been ongoing every year. This memorial was built from contributions from many different civic and businesses and service organizations throughout the St. Cloud area. Chapter 290, VVA Chapter 290, we had the honor of being very much involved in this and getting this monument up. And so this year we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of it. So anybody that all Vietnam veterans, all veterans are more than welcome to come and participate. Meet a lot of wonderful people from the Vietnamese community. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of Vietnam veterans that came here from the Vietnamese that came here under some very harsh conditions, and they got uprooted and basically kicked out of their country. And over the years, they've developed their friendships and their families and education, and they worked their way through society and into society, and they're wonderful people. They're very well educated. They care about their family and their friends, and of course, Vietnam. So this is a true. I don't like to use the word celebration in the same sentence with Memorial Day, but this is a celebration of friendship and a time to get together and talk and meet. So it's a good program.
Now, Bob, is there a good contingent of Vietnamese veterans in St. Cloud area and throughout the state?
Absolutely. Not only in St. Cloud, but St. Paul and Minneapolis. There's approximately 300, over 300 Vietnamese, Vietnam veterans. And so they all come in from all different parts of the state. They bring in some great food, music. It's all good. It's all good.
We're speaking with Bob Behrens, president of Chapter 290 St. Cloud of the VVA on Minnesota Military Radio. Bob, I want to talk to you a little bit now. You're the co-chair of the Agent Orange Committee on a national basis. Is that correct?
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. And so as that, you're studying the developments and what Congress is doing and what the VA has proven up. And you've been on the show before, and we've talked about the fact that there are a certain number of diseases that now have been presumed to have been caused by exposure to this herbicide called Agent Orange that we experienced in Vietnam. Are there any new developments on that?
Quite a few new developments, Tom. Last year, Congress passed the law for Agent Orange for our research bill. So now it's in the process of trying to find a veterans research hospital to look more into and study the effects and the causes of Agent Orange. So it's no longer a guessing game if we can, if we can't. The directives haven't changed with the VA. They still have to operate under certain directives. They cannot help out our children or grandchildren, but they do have a more solid basis, I guess, of what the symptoms are, such as the different cancers and the clubfoots and the web feet and things of this nature. And so they're getting closer to finally saying, okay, these diseases and were caused by Agent Orange. One of the interesting things that's come out now is with in California, under their Proposition 20, they passed a law where Roundup from Monsanto does have to carry a label that said it is cancer-causing. So we're continuing to push forward and be proactive on all fronts.
Bob, one of the things we've learned from a couple of VA doctors that have been on the show is that over all the years that we've been trying to figure out what Agent Orange did to us and to our children and our grandchildren, there's been a greater awareness that in every theater of war, there are certain things that have affected our soldiers and our service members, such as the first Gulf War when all the oil wells were burning, and in the recent wars where they've got these higher than normal incidence of ailments.
Yes.
And I think because of the hard work that the Vietnam veterans have done over the past 4 to 5 decades, the VA and the Congress is more aware that in different theaters of war, there are things that are going to affect our service members going forward.
Yeah, now they're starting to look in what they call toxic exposure research with the burn pits and the depleted uranium shells and things of this nature. And the what we call the modern-day warriors, Iraq, Afghanistan vets, they're getting more and more attention from the VA, and I think their scope is progressing a lot faster. And the VA is starting to understand and help these veterans with these health issues that they have.
And it's great that they're responding quicker to the younger generation.
Yes, they are. And, yeah, you're right. It's because of all the screaming and hollering and kicking and shouting that the Vietnam veterans did over the last four decades that they're starting to pay attention to them.
Raise the awareness for not just us, but for younger generations.
Absolutely.
Yes. Bob, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about a trip you took to Vietnam and this thing called the Squadron of Happy Hookers. We're talking to Bob Behrens on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking to Bob Behrens, who's the president of Chapter 290 of St. Cloud of the Vietnam Veterans of America, co-chairman of the Agent Orange Committee on a national basis, and chairman of the Squadron of Happy Hookers. And Bob, we had you on sometime last year, I think, and you were telling us about a trip you took back to Vietnam, and you had a nice young lady with you that did she could speak Vietnamese and help interpret those things. And when you were over there, did you see the remnants of the effects of Agent Orange on the Vietnamese people?
Very much so. It's everywhere you go. You know, Agent Orange is still prominent, very, very strong over there. A lot of third, fourth generation children are still being born with physical disabilities, mental challenges. It's everywhere. It's because of the saturation, I guess, lack of a better word, that we used in Vietnam, it's still prevalent in the jungles and in the cities. And children do not receive any type of medical treatment that we're afforded here. The government just doesn't help them, and the families don't have the resources. The medical community is very limited, and so it's sad to look at these orphanages. In Saigon, our Chapter 290, we support an orphanage, and over 80% of all the children there are suffering from symptoms of Agent Orange, anywhere from hip dysplasia to different cancers to heart diseases. It's there, and it's going to be a long, long time before any type of resolution to it.
And, Bob, that's the reason that you're chairman of the Squadron of Happy Hookers. That's not anything naughty.
No, sir. No.
But it's a fundraising operation,
yes,
isn't it?
Yep. It's the International Squadron of the Happy Hookers. And what we do is we manufacture and we sell fishing lures and key fobs, and we have coffee and coffee cups, this type of thing. And we're at different events and fairs. And all the money, 100% of all the money, goes to different organizations, one such as St. Cloud Hospital, Coburn Cancer Center. We take money and we also send over to Vietnam to the orphanage. So we have fun with it. We joke about it, but the bottom line is very serious. It's for the kids and faces of Agent Orange. Yes.
And the people that are part of your Squadron of Happy Hookers are mostly probably Vietnam veterans, many of whom are suffering from long lasting effects from Agent Orange themselves, but yet they're raising funds to help out.
Yeah, a lot of them are Vietnam veterans. We have a lot that are not veterans. A lot of them that have been married to veterans whose spouse has passed away over the past years because of Agent Orange. We have we've got close to 200 members that belong to the squadron, and we're in Canada, Australia, Norway. We're everywhere. And so it's a lot of fun. People recognize us as the Happy Hookers, but they also know that what we do, we're very proactive, and we're here for the children and to help them as best we can.
Bob, we just got about a minute left. Let's go back where we started. This is going to be the 10th anniversary of the Vietnamese Veterans Memorial Day ceremony up in St. Cloud. Tell us the time and place. And
This Saturday starts at noon, lasts about 2 hours. There'll be a picnic lunch afterwards, a flag ceremony. There'll be reading the names of veterans from Vietnam, from St. Cloud that died in Vietnam. And it's just a good time to get together and see old friends and be together.
Yep. Okay, last question, Bob. Your Chapter 290, Vietnam Veterans of America in St. Cloud. How often do you meet and where?
We meet the first Tuesday of every month in Sartell, VFW. We're about 183 strong. We get about 40, 45 members showing up each month. We're very, very active. It's just a good group of guys that get together, and we get things done. We get it done.
So if you're any Vietnam veterans living up around St. Cloud and want to join, get over there and join them and
Absolutely.
Add your name to the numbers so that when you go with the Commander's Task Force over to the state legislature, you can represent all of them on veterans issues such as Agent Orange.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, Tom. Greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir. That was Bob Behrens, president of Chapter 290, St. Cloud Vietnam Veterans of America. Joining me now is the senior enlisted advisor to the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham. Sergeant Major, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Hello, Tom, and as always, it is great to be with you again.
Sergeant Major, it's been a busy year so far, and I think it's going to get busier, but we got some good news today. You've got some troops coming home from the Sinai.
Yeah, we sure do. You know, our 2 of the 135, the Infantry Battalion out of Mankato, they've spent the last 9 months over in the Sinai for that multinational force and observers mission, and we're anxious to get them back in Minnesota within the next week.
Well, that'd be great to get them home. I'm sure they're happy to have accomplished their mission and get back to their families. And we also have some of our MPs down in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, we sure do. The 257th MP Company, they deployed not too long ago to Gitmo, about 120 packs down there. And with any luck, I'll get the opportunity to get down and visit them here later on this month just to check in and make sure everything's going well with them.
Well, that'll be a good trip. Make sure you tell them that all of Minnesota's pulling for them, sir.
Yes, we absolutely will. And of course, they do appreciate all of the support that we continue to send to them.
Sergeant Major, I understand you're going back to Europe.
I sure am, Tom. You know, that's the great thing about one of the great things about this job is the opportunity to travel, not only to see our soldiers out on their deployments, but to do some other things. And, you know, we've had a longstanding relationship with Croatia. That's our state partnership for peace country. And each year over in Germany, UCOM, United States Europe Command, they host a state partnership for peace conference. And so we'll have the opportunity to get together with Croatia, obviously, and then all of the other countries in the European area that have a relationship with another National Guard. We'll all get together and hear from UCOM so that we can ensure that the things that we do with our state partnership for peace country, that all those activities are fully nested in with what UCOM's broader security cooperation or their efforts are, so that we can make sure that we're always in line with what those theater campaign priorities are. So it's just a great opportunity to make sure we're on the same sheet of music and continue to foster those relationships.
Sergeant Major, it seems like there's a lot of training in Europe this year.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe. You know, they've got this Enhanced Forward Presence initiative. You know, this is a part of the UCOM commander's mission to make their 30,000 look like 300,000. And so we'll participate in saber strike with our 1st Brigade element, the 2 of the 136, over in Lithuania. And that'll be great because it coincides with this trip to Germany. So the Adjutant General and I will be able to travel, stop in, and see those troops in Lithuania and see how things are going for Saber Strike 17.
Sergeant Major, it seems like Saber Strike was another exercise in logistics. You had to ship, once again, a lot of equipment from Camp Ripley all the way out to the East Coast and get it over to Europe.
Yeah, we sure did. And, you know, I just can't express enough of how important our logistics community is. You know, we talk about training and training and training and doing the mission. And but I'll tell you what, if we can't get our equipment to where we need to be, or that equipment isn't running for us, you know, we're really stuck in the water, so to speak. So that logistics community has done just a fantastic job. Of course, they had a rail load stuff again, just like we talked about when the 1st Brigade went to the National Training Center last summer. It was the same type of an exercise, putting all of those pieces of equipment on that train and heading them down to the port so that we can get them on a ship and get them overseas. So,
and Sergeant Major, I understand your mechanics up at Camp Ripley did an amazing job of getting all that equipment back from the California desert and getting it ready to go in short order.
Absolutely in short order, and it was a quick turnaround. You know, when you run that equipment like they were running it at NTC, a lot of stuff gets broken. It's just the nature of the beast, and again, our mechanics just they put in the extra time and the extra effort and did a fantastic job for us.
Sergeant Major, I used to hear that join the Navy, you get to see the world, but we've been following the Minnesota National Guard for 6.5 years now, and you've been around the world as well. Great opportunity for our young people if they want to join the Minnesota National Guard, isn't there?
There absolutely is great opportunity. I mean, not only do you get to serve your country and serve a bigger cause, but there are other opportunities that come along, and just a great benefit and a great way to give back.
Sergeant Major, thanks for joining us again today.
Hey, Tom, thanks so much. I hope you have a great rest of the day, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you, sir. That was the Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Doug Becky, Bob Behrens, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham, Commissioner Larry Shelato of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we get a wrap-up of Minnesota's Veteran Legislative Session, and we'll meet with Minnesota's first female Army General. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at minnesotamilitaryradio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at minnesotamilitaryradio.com.